It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. I'm all alone in the studio. We sent everybody home. It's dark. It's New Year's Eve. And people are on vacation. So here's what we're going to do. A best of episode. Some of the best moments from the year's best episodes. And frankly, most of these were picked by you. So thank you for your contributions. I'm glad you're here. A great Twit ahead.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 647 for New Year's Eve 2017, the year's best. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who've hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Welcome to This Week in Tech. Leo Laporte here, all alone in the studio. But don't worry, I won't be alone for long. Everybody makes an appearance in this show practically. We started the year, of course, with the inauguration of the new president, and Silicon Valley had kind of mixed reactions, especially to the immigration ban. Watch. I mean, I guess we have to talk about, and I have mixed feelings about talking about politics. We try to keep to politics only where it intersects with technology. But in fact, there's a pretty big intersection. This is, of course, concluding of President Trump's first week in office, a lot of executive orders, and one yesterday that seemed to have really triggered a reaction from Silicon Valley. I shouldn't even say that, from all of the tech community, and that's his ban on immigrants, visitors from seven nations that are predominantly Muslim. But more than that, even green card holders, legal residents of the United States, were blocked at the border. There was some question of whether that was the intent. Apparently, the Border Control called the White House and said, now, do you want us to stop green card holders, too? And they said, you bet. And a number of people were detained. The tech community's reaction to this was of varying strengths. Mark Zuckerberg, one of the first to respond with a somewhat tepid response on Facebook, saying he didn't think it was a good idea, but not really calling it out. On the other hand, Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, immediately went to San Francisco International Airport to join the protests there. And then there's Sergey. He, of course, is also an immigrant from the Soviet Union, Phil. I think so. Yeah. Why is Silicon Valley upset about this?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not sure that the tech community is doing much good on this issue.
They may actually be causing more problems.
Yeah, or even kind of in the election in general. I think we are a little bit tone deaf about exactly who cares about what we think and who doesn't. I think we may be becoming like Hollywood in this sense.
Good point, but it's reasonable for Google, for instance, that has nearly 200 employees that are blocked by this order.
Of course.
People were, if they were overseas, would not be able to come back to Google.
Sure.
Many Google employees said, since our colleagues can't travel, we are not going to travel anymore. Mm-hmm. Google issued a statement saying, we're concerned about the impact of this order and any proposals that could impose restrictions on Googlers and their families, or that could create barriers to bringing great talent to the U.S. We continue to make our views on these issues known to leaders in Washington and elsewhere. It does sound like they're not condemning the order. They're more just saying, hey, this impacts our business, so we're not happy about that.
Yeah, and of course, every company has a responsibility to its employees and to make sure that that everyone's okay and that business doesn't get interrupted. And the much larger question is, I think we do have some moral responsibilities to refugees, to immigrants. But I do think the discussion on both sides here has been pretty poor and not helpful. There's very few reasonable voices here.
When the tech leaders, and Tim Cook, by the way, is in Washington right now, the CEO of Apple. He had dinner with Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, Trump's advisor, on Thursday, has been going around making the rounds. Cook issued a statement, said, I've heard from many of you who are deeply concerned about the executive order issued yesterday restricting immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries. I share your concerns. It is not a policy we support. That was probably the strongest kind of statement from all the CEOs. But Tim Cook went and sat down along with Elon Musk. In fact, Musk's now met twice. He met again this week with President Trump. Do you agree, having been in a position like this, do you agree with them that it's important to meet with the incoming president?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see...
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I don't see what's to be gained by kind of shouting about everything.
Right.
I think it's just going to make the world worse. So there should be reasonable people on both sides. It's sometimes hard to do that. There's a lot of pressure to take a strong position. There's a lot of pressure to be very vocal. It's good that a lot of people are doing that, but I think we also need people who are actually trying to be reasonable and move the world forward.
Right, but when you're championing yourself as a beacon of hope and light, and basically, you know, constantly claiming that you're guiding the United States to this you know, new frontier of greatness through technology, right. I think that you owe it to the people that you've promised, both American citizens but also your employees, to take a stand against some of this stuff. Because I mean, you know, I won't say that every single thing that Donald Trump is doing is wrong, but there are certainly some measures that can be just described accurately as xenophobic and problematic when it comes to sourcing talent from other countries and basically creating this, you know, this new and open world that all of these Silicon Valley companies are constantly talking about. So I was actually really disappointed by the number of leaders that were willing to speak out and the amount of time that it took them to actually say something. You know, there are people like Sheryl Sandberg who have spent years talking about progressive ideals and then when push comes to shove, have actually been, you know, pretty quiet about these things.
She did finally issue a statement about not about the immigration thing, but about the women's or no, I think Planned Parenthood, the Women's March. She said
that's right. Yep.
Yeah. So, but you're right. She hasn't said a lot, and but like, I think as a C-level executive at a publicly held company, there is some responsibility to not be political, not to be to become a Meryl Streep, but to in fact to be more judicious. Is that right?
So look, I have personal opinions on all this stuff, and I'm actually totally happy talking about them.
Yeah. But that's separate.
Totally happy talking about them.
Yeah.
What I also trying to be mindful of is what's actually going to be the most effective way for the world to move in the direction that I would like it to move.
Right.
And very often that's not telling people from a position of assumed authority what they should think and how they should think.
So how would you go about it?
Well, for example, it's not clear to me that Sheryl Sandberg, like, being louder and faster about her position actually helps convince the people that need to be convinced to change the position.
Right.
Like, it maybe makes people feel better. It maybe makes for better demonstrations. I'm not sure that it actually makes the world, it pushes the world further in the direction that Sheryl would want it to be pushed.
There's also a significant risk, I think, of silicon. At some point, people realizing that the problem isn't so much immigration. Mm-hmm. The problem is more created by Silicon Valley and automation, and that, in fact, the tech community could quickly become the enemy here, could they not?
We are pretty tone deaf as an industry, I think. I think we are like, we got used to being treated as heroes and kind of the people that are making the world for the past decade or so, and I think that's on the verge of changing. I think we're kind of tone deaf about how we talk about it. I think like Hollywood tripped over that line a while ago.
Hollywood's given up. Hollywood doesn't care. Hollywood's Hollywood, and I think most people in California feel the same way.
And we're close to following that.
Right. And the tech industry could be going over that line.
I would like us not to. I'd like us to remain effective. And I think that a little bit hurts that.
What I've learned over the past week is that Silicon Valley continues to exist in a bubble that is essentially unrelatable for a large majority of Americans, right? You know, there is a... there's been a diversity problem in Silicon Valley for years that is basically underreported and under discussed. And I think, I don't want to put all of the blame on Sheryl Sandberg, but I think, she in particular is an easy target because she wants to be, or she, positioned herself to be considered a leader for the feminist movement and wrote the book Lean In. Right. And so I think, there is such divisive, rhetoric, that is just constantly coming, from Washington, I think that, you kind of have to choose you kind of have to choose one way or another. Either you're purely a capitalist and that's totally fine and you can refrain from saying anything, but then you can't go on to expect to be treated as an authoritative leader on any progressive movement. So I think,
I think, Phil, you're saying they shouldn't be a leader in the progressive movement. They should stick to their knitting and do their job. Although I can understand why Sergey Brin, who, went to that protest, but I think as a private citizen, I don't think he said, I'm bearing the banner of Google, but as a private citizen, I feel strongly about this because I was a refugee.
I think you got three different issues here that are being conflated. One is the issue of how publicly should people state their views? And the answer to that is as publicly as they want.
Yeah.
Everyone can make that decision and state them as publicly as they want.
Right.
Second issue is what is the proper role of someone speaking for a company?
That's a different matter entirely.
Entirely. And then there's a third issue, which is what's most effective.
Right.
And it's that most effective issue where we are about to go over a cliff as an industry, where we're about to take everything that we in general think is important and significantly hold those things back by being perceived as hectoring and lecturing and being tone deaf and being out of touch. We will make the situation worse if we keep doing
it. So can I say something? I've been real quiet because I'm trying not to do the yelling thing that you said because I'm prone to
do that.
I feel like
we are on the edge right now, on the precipice of a patented O Doctor rant.
So as a person who doesn't live in the bubble, I think that you're generally wrong when you say that the tech community is tone deaf and that Hollywood is tone deaf. The country in a majority voted an opposite direction of what we currently have as a regime, the popular number of people. Mm-hmm. So that the way the people are speaking and when they speak out, it's not tone deaf in general unless you live in the middle of the country and you've seen your job creation go away. As opposed to in Silicon Valley where everything's becoming automated, we're not talking about what educations people need to be having and what we should do for education for people to have these new future jobs. Because until we get the robots to build themselves, build the wall, pay the taxes for it, we've got to do some other things and fix these issues. So yes, it's important for a CEO of a major company who has immigrants working for them, mostly as engineers or whatever they have, because you never really see them on a higher echelon of work and jobs.
Well, wait a minute. Satya Nadella, Sundar Pichai.
I said in general, and don't talk to me like that, because he just made the statement of the fact the way that racially, the way Silicon Valley is, you know how it is in general. I said in general. I didn't say all.
Okay.
I didn't say every. I said generally.
Okay.
So again, let me finish. The way things are set up. I'm just saying that they're not tone deaf, and maybe if we did a little bit better educating the people in the middle of the country about what's about to happen to them, maybe we don't have to fall off a cliff or push ourselves off a cliff or rappel off a cliff.
I agree with you on that. There is a leadership role Silicon Valley could take, which is, look, the change is coming. We understand this change. You might want to get ready for this. This is the educational. I mean, you push STEM, but these are things you've got to do. As a country, we've got to do to prepare ourselves, and it's not building a wall, because that's not going to solve the problem. That's not where the problem's coming from. That's a mistake.
The best thing I saw for that was, instead of building a wall, why don't we build a solar panel wall out there in the desert and get some free energy? I'm sitting like it's the little things like that. I'm like a 12-year-old said it, and you're like, that'd be amazing.
All right, how many of you bought Snap stock? We had Kevin Rose on yesterday. He said I passed on Snap. You pass on Snap?
It's unethical for me.
Yeah,
we can't. Hyper. Peter, you could.
I could, but I passed.
Oh.
So I think that...
Why, you don't believe in millennials? Sorry, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
I don't see age. I actually think that it probably will be a little bit like Facebook, where you had this big pop, people got excited, and then they have a slowdown in earnings or growth doesn't shape up as quickly as possible, and it drops, and so maybe I'll buy it when it drops.
They're apparently they expect as many as $1 billion. I'm sorry. Stop. Stop. I had autoplay video. I thought I had it turned off. Apparently not. Apparently there's as much as $1 billion in shorting going on right now in Snap. There's a lot of people betting, as you will, that pop will go away. They were saying that they were gonna, and you'll help me with this because you're the financial guy.
Sure.
Right. They were saying initially that the IPO would be $14 to $16. They ended up opting for $17,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Which means they took a lot of money off the table. For the founders, each took $300 million for themselves.
$250 million and $300 million. Yeah, I forget the final number, but right in there.
Right in there. In the first day, they went from 17 Actually, they started trading at $24 a share, which means there was a lot of institutional and insider trading up front, right, before they
went. Well, you set a price. It's a big dance on the first day of the IPO because you sell the shares to the underwriters. You fill the book beforehand at $17 a share. And then the opening price is set by kind of a give and take. It takes place in the NASDAQ.
The underwriters, they got special clients. They got people they particularly like. They get let them in on the deal,
yeah,
right?
You and I are not going to get
we don't
a
get
lot
that.
Of IPO allocation, I wouldn't think.
If you did, if you were lucky enough to, 44% pop by the time the day was done, $24.48. And I don't know what it is right now. Share prices went as high as 26. Made a lot of people very rich, including one parochial high school.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which one was it? In
the story is...
It was in Los Gatos, right?
Yeah, it was a Bay Area high school.
Of course.
Story is that...
St. Francis.
Barry Eggers... You may know his name. He's at Lightspeed Ventures. They were one of the early Snap investors.
They were the first?
Yeah, they were the first. They made a lot of money, right? They had
a really good
26,000% return.
But Barry spread the wealth because he's a parent at that high school. Yeah. And the high school, which is weird, had an investment fund, a financial growth fund. He's the chairman. And he said, hey, I'll get you a taste of that.
Silicon Valley thing to do.
I'll get you a taste of that. So they bought $15,000 in shares, which are worth... Now, well, they sold two-thirds of them. They got $24 million.
That's a new gymnasium.
Did your high school have a fund? Because my public high school had like two pencils.
I know.
Let alone
a fund. I went to a Pentecostal Christian school, so I'm not.
If they have endowments, though, they have to invest in endowments. So a lot of private schools have endowments. People leave them money or whatever. It may not be a lot of money.
School had an endowment.
So. $15,000 though is not a huge amount. I would have loved to have invested $15,000, and sold. They didn't even sell all of it.
You know what? Hindsight is always 20/20 on these things. If you put $15,000 into Uber or $15,000 into a lot of things, you'd be,
True.
Alternatively, Clinkle or Washio.
Well, that's the problem. You don't know. Is it a Clinkle or is it a Snap? You don't know.
Yeah.
Simon Chu is the president of St. Francis High School.
Tell me about it.
Said. Barry, this is the president of the school, Barry now joins the illustrious list of individuals and families whose foresight and generosity have enriched St. Francis High School.
So enriched.
They should come enrich my student loans.
Come enrich me. No. Wow.
New York Times, is American retail at a historic tipping point?
Oh, yeah, and that goes with the zombie shopping mall story, too.
Yeah.
What's wrong?
Sure does.
What's wrong with America's retailers?
More workers in general merchandise stores have been laid off since October. About 89,000 Americans, more than all of the people employed in the United States coal industry.
Yeah, I mean that's basically the coal industry is Arby's. This is like retail.
Yeah, this is this particular sector of the economy, which is huge, going down the toilet.
One analyst said the change is coming at you so fast it feels like it's accelerating. The transformation's hollowing out suburban shopping malls, bankrupting longtime brands, and leading to staggering job losses. What's the zombie shopping mall?
Well, they did it's like photos in another story that's related to this. It's probably linked from it. That is, it's the same idea, is that there are certain malls that have recast themselves and they've gone higher end and they've been successful.
There's a reason to go.
But there are a lot of them that are just falling apart because, their anchor stores are Macy's and JCPenney. And those are not drawing people in. And it turns out that so many people are preferring to shop at big box stores or on the internet that the traditional shopping mall is now a lot less appealing. And so some of them can redefine
Macy's
themselves.
Macy's is closing like 100 stores.
But a lot of them can't. And like Sears and Kmart, which Sears owns Kmart, that is a company that may not make it at all. They may just go out of business. And so they what do you do with that space? And how do you turn it into something else?
Oh, yeah, the story is good, too.
This is Amazon.
A lot of it, and there are other trends, too, like, Walmart.
And Amazon is hiring. Didn't they just announce they're going to hire, tens of thousands
of people?
By
the way, the worst jobs ever. You're working in these very...
That is an issue.
Yeah, difficult conditions.
With robots that will eventually replace you there, too.
And eventually you'll have pick-and-pull robots.
But I feel bad, but I'm happier buying my stuff on Amazon Prime than going to the mall.
Me too. Do you buy clothes on Amazon?
Yeah.
Do you buy shoes on Amazon?
Yeah, I just did.
See, those are the reasons people would go somewhere is to try something on to see how it looks in person.
I still do that to a certain degree.
A terrible shopping interface, though, for stuff like clothes.
Yeah. So I'll get a pair of shoes at some point at a local store, and I'll pay a lot for them. But when I want a refill, when I want that shoe again, if I can get it on Amazon, I'll just get it again because I know it fits and I know that I like it.
Yeah.
So it tends to be like the first purchase is at a store, but then if I want 10 more down the road, they don't get my sale because, you know, I paid them for their marked up first version, but then in the end it's just so much more convenient to say, you know, it's 6 months later and I want another one of these. I'm just going to have it.
I'm in my sister's wedding in a couple months and I bought 3 pairs of shoes on Amazon last week.
Partly because it's easy to return, right?
Yeah.
You buy as many as you want to look at. You look at them at home. You don't have to look at them in the store. They talk about a Burlington shopping mall, which used to have 100 stores, now has 20.
Yeah.
20 tenants. Last Wednesday, a woman came to the mall looking for shoes but left frustrated because the Payless store had just shuttered. 2 years ago, the mall's owners announced a $230 million renovation, but the plans have stalled. You know, I mean, I can't say I'm sad that malls are going out of business because, you know, but I'm sad about all the lost jobs and the lost sense of community. Pretty soon, nobody's going to even leave the house anymore, right? Why would you need to? You've got a robot bringing you food.
Right. Drones are bringing all your groceries to you. By the way, I on Twitter yesterday, I asked about what you'd find at the zombie shopping mall. So, Forever Dead at 21. Victim on a Stick. Abercrumbling and Fitch was from my friend Phil. Coffin and Barrel. That's a good one.
I love this.
There are a lot of Saks Fifth Circle of Hell was a good one. Skinnabon from Cable Sasser. I like that one. And, of course, the Microsoft Store. Anyway.
Ow!
Zing! The last one has to be a real one, right? It has to be.
That's the joke, right there.
It could be Nordstrom if you prefer.
Wow!
But yeah, zombie shop. It is scary, right? This is when we talk about like the future of work being impacted by automating things. Before we even get to that, we're going to have the future of these whole sectors like retail, where just the convenience of online shopping.
It's happening. This is not the future.
And where there is retail success, it is at Walmarts and Costco's and other kind of like big box stores, Targets, that are not the mall where it's like trying to replicate the old downtown of a city where there are 50 different shops. Now, that's also kind of peeling away.
I love this this story. I'm going to jump all over today because you guys are playful, so we can have some fun. The Dark Overlord. The Dark Overlord has apparently hacked the production company that had Orange is the New Black and a bunch of shows from ABC, Fox, National Geographic, and IFC. And they tried to blackmail Netflix. They said, we have the next season of Orange is the New Black, which comes out in June. And if you don't pay us, we're going to put it on the torrents. Well, Netflix just laughed at them. So they put it on the torrents on yesterday.
Netflix was like,
big
make
deal.
House of Cards, dum-dum. We know how blackmail works.
Well,
you can't do this.
Yeah, right. Orange is the New Black, according to Netflix, is their most popular Netflix original. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
They're very cagey about giving out numbers for each of their individual shows. Mm-hmm. So that is actually a real key piece of information for the industry.
According to Variety, the studio is a ADR, which is what? Something dialogue recording, additional dialogue recording, Larson Studios. They got hacked in the fall, but the hacker doesn't have the whole season, just the first 10 episodes. So Netflix is going, yeah, go, that's great. It's a great promo. You still have to subscribe to Netflix to find out what happens.
Oh, you're not going to get that season finale. You got to subscribe, find out.
These hackers have really good taste because I feel like Orange is the New Black doesn't get as much talk or as much as like House of Cards or something.
Yeah, so no, you're really right. Good. It's like, it's less, that's this is a good hype man.
It's a great series.
I bet you it's an inside job. What a great marketing campaign by Netflix.
So now you're telling me that Dark Overlord is actually a Netflix employee trying to beat up.
Well, first of all,
it's obviously Reed Hastings, guys. It's obviously Reed Hastings, the Dark Overlord. He probably calls himself that in executive meetings.
What kind of hacker names himself the Dark Overlord? I mean,
a very young one.
This is a 14-year-old.
Definitely a kid.
And by the way,
a kid of somebody who works at that ADR house, right?
Yeah.
Like that's what we're all guessing.
Is dopey.
That it's gonna something like that?
Yeah. His Twitter handle has a 3 in it in the word hacker.
Oh, that's leet.
He's leet. So you know he's really anyway.
Serious.
The deadline passed. He posted it and then he did a press release. He called it a press release.
Oh, that's adorable.
He called it a press. It's so cute. He's so adorable. He called. Let's go to the Dark Overlord hacker. No, this isn't it. I'm trying to find. There's apparently many Dark Overlords on Twitter.
There's so many. I'm surprised he needed. He didn't. Was like the Dark Overlord 46.
Oh, this is terrible. Anyway, I'm trying to find the Dark Overlord press release because it's the funniest thing I ever read. Let me see if I can find it somewhere. Can you find it, Karsten? Because he's kind of...
Is it the one where he says it didn't have to be this way?
It didn't have to be this way.
That was my favorite. He says it didn't have to be this way, Netflix. Wait, can I just make...
Dark Overlord for us, Ashley Esquetta?
I'll be Dark Overlord, guys. I'll be Dark Overlord. It didn't have to be this way, Netflix. You're going to lose a lot of money in all of this than what our modest offer was. We're quite ashamed to breathe the same air as you.
Wait a minute, what? We're quite ashamed to breathe the same air as you?
So ashamed. We figured a pragmatic business such as yourself would see and understand the benefits of cooperating with a reasonable and merciful entity like ourselves.
Merciful. We are the merciful Dark Overlord.
Yeah. And I really love the end where he says, and to the others. There's still time to save yourselves. Our offers are still on the table for now.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you what, if I ever do something like this, I am going to be the Dark Overlord so that attribution just becomes a disaster. Like, if you're going to do this, you do not want people tracking you down. You do not want...
No.
This is a really good way to obfuscate people tracking you down because they're going to go like hitting Netflix is going to be like bad news bears. They can come after you, right? There's some smart people at Netflix.
But I'm the Dark Overlord. Like,
you know what I mean? Like,
don't mess with me.
That's right.
I'm going to get my braces off in 6 months and then you'll be sorry.
But please don't arrest me before prom, guys.
Didn't we see this person on social media? The person with the raven on the subway? Pretty sure that's the Dark Overlord.
I think you're right.
The person with the live raven. Yeah.
Do I need to get my hoodie and put my hoodie on like Mr. Robot?
Even Mr. Robot didn't call himself the Dark Overlord. Come on, kid. Come on.
Get a good handle.
Dark Overlord.
I love that. That's so difficult.
You know, I'll tell you right now, like, if I could give you some advice, Dark Overlord, if you're watching, do not hack HBO. Because if you take Game of Thrones, they will literally hire Liam Neeson to find you. Like, it will be the plot of Taken, the next Taken movie. Yeah. It will be very serious.
Yeah. I found the Dark Overlord, who's apparently a Vincent Van Gogh fan.
Oh, big time.
He says, yeah. And there
was no copyright on Vincent Van Gogh.
Oh. he doesn't want to offend.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Ashley, you do that voice very well. You will get to play the Dark Overlord when we make the movie.
Oh, my God. In the motion picture. The Pirates of Silicon Valley. The Dark Overlord can be the villain in that movie. It'll be great.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. I love Ashley Esquetta's Dark Overlord. That, to me, that may be one of the best of all. And by the way, just to, kind of circle round. No, Dark Overlord did not take his or her revenge on Ashley. She survived unscathed, unscathed. Our show today brought to you by GoToWebinar. We're really pleased. We always do these best ofs, but often we don't have advertisers. But GoToWebinar came to us right at the last moment and said, we'd like to buy the best of. So they're sponsoring all the best ofs. Thank you, GoToWebinar. GoToWebinar is great. I've used it. I've done a number of webinars with GoToWebinar. I'm not alone. They've hosted 2.7 million interactive web events this year. That's 60 million views. That's one of the things that's cool. What is that average then? More than 20 people per webinar, but it can be even bigger. GoToWebinar lets you present from 1 to 6 presenters, as many people who can see it as you want, both live and on demand. And that's really, really you get the, all the big audiences is you create a live webinar. With live audience, you have polls, 20 polls, up to 20 polls per webinar, up to 20 questions per poll. You can set them up ahead of time. You can do it in the middle of the webinar if you don't, people don't understand or you're worried that people are, you just want to know more about your audience, whatever. You do that during the live webinar, but the live webinar is recorded and the polls are live and the numbers are live on the on-demand version. So that's really neat. People can still interact with it, still feel like it's got the excitement of a live event, but you don't have to be there. But you can do this webinar once and watch and have millions of people see it after the fact. It can be completely branded with your company's logo and custom image and all the webinar materials. Easy to start, too. They have automated mail templates that let you send out custom email invitations and confirmations and reminders. That's really important. Mobile friendly, that's right. You can do this, by the way, on your phone, iOS or Android. And you can not only schedule a webinar, set it up, but you can edit a session and track performance. Speaking of tracking, they have lots of metrics. So it's a great way if you're doing sales presentations to gather leads, if you're teaching to get a sense of how many students attended the whole thing. And actually, that's very helpful in making your webinar better. Were they paying attention? Did they stick around? So that the next time you even get more engagement. I am a fan of GoToWebinar. I want you to try it. GoToWebinar.com/podcast is the special address. That way they know you saw it on our Best Of episodes. GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Thank you, GoToWebinar, for making this New Year's Eve presentation even a little bit more special. Pop the champagne, folks. Mark Zuckerberg running for president? Imagine yourself a small town, Newton Falls, Ohio. Nothing ever happens exciting. You get a phone call from a company saying a billionaire philanthropist wants to have dinner with you next week. I can't tell you his name. In fact, I won't tell you his name until 15 minutes before he arrives. Would you be willing to? This family said yes. And here's the picture of Mark Zuckerberg in meeting real people.
The grandmother to his left looks like, oh God,
you know, anytime you'd see this picture, you'd assume she's looking at a smartphone, but there aren't any smartphones in evidence. They're eating on plastic plates because apparently Mark won't eat real people's food, so they had it catered.
Oh, is that why?
Yeah.
Did they really have that? Did they really have it catered?
They had it catered.
Oh my gosh.
And this is in Business Insider, said that Mark's people were tapping away at their laptops in the other room. Like he brings an entourage.
Oh, of course he brings. Yeah. So here's the thing. Okay. I want to ask the panel here. So I wrote a piece, I don't know, a few months ago saying it sure as heck looks like Mark Zuckerberg's running for president. And there was some people that were like, absolutely. When you look at all these photos, and there were other people like, you're completely wrong. What is going on? Like, what is he doing? And don't tell me he's just going around the country meeting people, because if he was doing that, why would he be
specifically
with a
said to this family, would you, if when the press calls you, and they will, please tell them I'm not running for president.
So, yeah, I don't think he's old enough to run for president, is he?
Yes.
No,
so here's
he could be when he in 2020.
He turns 35 1 month before the filing deadline for 2020.
I mean, I think it's possible. I think it's highly improbable.
Really?
No.
Why is he doing this then?
Why is he?
I think maybe eventually doing that. They've got a massive press problem on their hands right now with fake news. And
does this make people feel better about fake news to see Mark sitting at this table
with catered food?
I mean, really? I think you're right, Amy. I think he's not running for in this cycle. He's not running in 2020. Yeah. By there he is driving a tractor. Oh, please.
I have to tell you, I feel like I have a special point of view on this because, you know, I'm out there. In fact, right before I got here, I'm out there in Hull, Massachusetts.
You're doing
Frank and I. I'm doing this. And the thought of inviting myself over to someone's house is so deeply uncomfortable. And if you want to meet people, this is a completely wrong, really weird way to go about it. Like, I have people that write me every week and I go, do you want to have coffee? And that sitting down in private and talking, it's not making it this weird media thing. And
it's clear he brings photographers, lights. Look at this picture, really talking to a fire department. This looks so canned, phony, and staged. He doesn't. Yeah. It looks like he's been green screened into this.
Okay.
The better question is though: So, Brianna, you're asking people if they want to have coffee with you. Wouldn't Zuck just tell us we're going to have coffee with him through the miracles of AI and machine learning? And like, why bother going out into the real world when you have everybody's data at your fingertips?
I think you're both right. I think.
Can we hold on? Can we look at this other evidence here pointing to a political campaign? So they updated their S-1 filing with the SEC to note that if Mark Zuckerberg decides to run for office, that he could still remain CEO. Why would you put that in there if that didn't mean anything? They've been hiring people from the Obama campaign, on the foundation. There's just all of these things that he's been doing, and these photos, it doesn't add up. There's people that have been telling me, oh well, it's just a PR push, but it's giving them more negative PR around this whole president thing. If the goal
what
is
the hell does he
to,
want to be president for, though? I mean, honestly.
I have a theory. I don't know if it's president, because I do think that it's too small of a job for him. I wonder.
He wants to be emperor of the world?
He wants to
What's
be
bigger
of the world?
Than president of the United States?
No, maybe he's going to try out for like governor or even mayor or I don't know, something now, kind of, you know, as a testing ground. But there's something going on. There's clearly something going on.
I think, Amy, you're right. There is a question. In fact, many of our panelists have said this in the past. He's already got he's a king maker. He doesn't need to be the king. Always better to be the king maker, the Richelieu, rather than, you know, because then you have more power, frankly, the king maker. However, so I don't think he's running in 2020. I think, though, that this is he's playing the long game, that at point he would. Look at this.
You don't do that because
of fake news. You don't feed a cow.
I don't know. I got to say, because I'm, you know, we advise many, many, many news organizations, and also not this administration, but the previous administration. And he's got a pretty massive problem on his hands. And if every news organization in the country, in our country, decided to cut off the tap, that would be a tremendous problem.
Well, they're doing it, right? Instant Articles has lost the New York Times. They've lost the Washington Post.
Part of this may be politics, but I also think that there's a piece of this that's a PR mistake.
Amy, how does this help fake news or instant articles? I don't understand helps anything.
Can you imagine, were to connect the dots?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that it.
This is your job, Amy. This is what you do. You're predicting the future for us.
So here's the thing. My hunch here is that we're also easily distracted, no matter how smart we are and how, you know, prestigious our jobs might be. We get distracted over and over again. And my first career was as a journalist. So this is not about me, you know, disliking journalists or anything like that. I just think we get distracted. And I think that that campaign, whether it was for politics or for straight up, you know, ingratiating Zuck and Facebook back into everybody's good graces, I think was more about, was a lot about likability. I think that has a reverberating effect. I really do.
I think you have to look at the big picture here too. I mean, he recently gave away a huge portion of his wealth for, you know, philanthropy worldwide. I know it's quirky. But my point there is he's trying to, you know, raise an international presence here. And when he has a positive view by the mass public, I think it enables him to, you know, do a lot of things. Like if Facebook is trying to, you know, work with local governments, that's a huge part of what they end up doing. So I see this as an overall political move meant to open many doors for him. And maybe he runs for president, maybe he doesn't, but it certainly makes a lot of the things Facebook wants to do just easier.
So I would mention to Mark's team that just remember Mike Dukakis in the tank with the helmet, that picture with basketball players does not show it again. Does not raise Zuck's stature. That is probably the one you want to throw out. I'm just saying.
Also, I think here's the thing. Let's just pretend that the four of us run Mark's public relations team. Can you imagine? Oh guys, there's been this huge problem with fake news. What do we do? And someone says, I know. Let's go take a picture of Mark feeding a cow.
Well, remember that.
Wait, Nick, how many different places did we all see that photo? I completely agree with you, but
yeah,
it worked in that respect.
But That's right. That's right.
So he did, you know, Mark does, as we know, these things. Like he was going to only cook and kill his own. He was only going to eat meat he killed.
Yep.
He was going to learn Chinese and actually did, which is kind of impressive. Having tried that for myself for 4 years in school, it's not easy. So one of his goals for this year was to go to all 50 states, talk to people in all 50 states. So you could just say on the surface that he's just doing his weird kind of, I'm a billionaire, I could do anything I want. So instead of building a rocket ship, I'm going to meet everybody in every state.
I don't know. I didn't see photos of him like studying or whatever. I didn't
conjugating exactly. verbs.
Exactly. Right. Like sitting.
Ni hao. Ni hao.
Did you see photos of him killing his animals? No. So why are we seeing photos of this stuff?
So we all agree it's PR.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Oh, look at meeting generals. Now, that's important. You gotta meet generals if you're going to. Is that an American general? What uniform is that? I've never seen that hat before. What is that?
So here's the other thing. I do want to say one other thing. So there was when I written that Vanity Fair piece, BuzzFeed went along to Zuck. They got access to him and they said, "Are you running for president?" And he said, "No." And then there was this big story like Zuck says he's not running for president. Of course he's not going to say he's running for president. It's the Facebook stock would literally drop 20-30% right. in 5 seconds.
Right.
So yeah. I think that we should not take it as face value when he says no or don't tell people I'm running for president. There is something going on and we should be questioning it.
So what do you want to start? You want to start with Google? Google I.O.?
Well, Google I.O. was kind of it should have been the biggest news of the week.
And it wasn't.
And it really kind of, I think, let a lot of people down. There's actually a lot of significant stuff. It just, they didn't really explain why the stuff mattered that good.
Well, and much of the stuff wasn't available yet.
Well, that's part of Google's problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Gizmodo's piece by Michael Nunez was the best that said that you just can't see that. It's neater stuff, but you can't see it. You can't touch it.
Well, and you know, in Google's defense, that's a good point. I mean, if you're making big strides in artificial intelligence, well, that just kind of slips away. If that's one of the things Sundar Pichai said, he says we're moving from a mobile first world. By the way, I'm just catching up with mobile first.
Yeah, a lot of companies are.
We're moving from a mobile first world to a AI first world. And that's kind of interesting.
And well, that was kind of the sell last year for Google I.O. I think,
thought they said the same thing. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
One of the things that sticks out to me is if you look at the complaints before Sundar took over as CEO about a year ago now, a lot of it was that you go to Google I.O. and you see all these like really fun gee whiz kind of ideas that aren't necessarily fully realized, that are costing a lot of money. Sundar came in as CEO and kind of focused the company, got rid of a lot of that sort of thing. And this is really what the company's focused on. And so this is iterative stuff versus last year in this AI-first idea. And it's good progress. Like the cloud TPU set up is basically these computer chips that will help their machine learning systems.
The tensor processing units.
Yeah,
that's probably faster. The biggest news of the event, right?
This is exactly.
It has huge business implications.
Fascinating. So these are inexpensive, almost. They look like almost like Raspberry Pis. They got four processors on them, big heavy duty GPU stuff. This is no Raspberry Pi, 180 teraflops.
Yeah. And so this could give them an advantage in their cloud services versus Amazon. This could give them an advantage in building out their AI.
They're also making it available to third parties as part of the Google Compute
that
Cloud.
They want
to
build AI software.
So they've already open sourced TensorFlow, the software, and these are hardware devices designed to run TensorFlow at speed. And if you're impressed with 180 teraflops, that's really not the point, because the idea is they massively parallelize them.
Yeah.
And these racks are multi-petaflops per. This is 11.5 petaflops of machine learning in this rack.
And so what I think the missing piece really was Sundar or somebody else from Google saying, hey, here are the cool things we'll be able to build with this technology. Here's the stuff that you developers should come and help us build together. Regular people watching this, consumers and enthusiasts, here's what the future is going to look like. And here's the vision, right? So Sundar's Google doesn't do as good of a job at illustrating that vision in these keynotes
as you know.
Let's face it, tech journalists would rather have Sergey Brin parachuting in with Google goggles on, even though
on a better show.
It's a better show, well, but it's equally show. Meaningless.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
Not even equally.
Maybe more so.
Much more meaningless.
Yeah,
yeah, right?
Genuinely meaningless.
Yeah.
So it's less exciting, but this is probably one of the most significant things Google's announced.
And I think that's really right. It's enabling. Right. You remember the name of that guy we talked about on the show for like an hour once? Was he Swiss or an Austrian AI genius?
Yeah.
I can't remember his name. It was a great name.
Either. Yeah.
Jurgen somebody. Yeah. But he talked about how the theory is so far ahead of the practice because of exactly what you just said, Nate, is that the power to do what they want to do isn't there. So their theory is way ahead. And this.
Oh,
this
Jurgen Schmidhuber. You're talking about Jurgen Schmidhuber.
Jurgen Schmidhuber. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Not the best website I've ever seen.
See, I can't tell if this is like he hasn't updated his website since like 1996 or if it's like so an it's ironic, like I want machines. It to look this way, like in kind of like a hipster.
Oh, click on what's new.
Yeah.
What's new? 12 May 2017. But I've also Good. Probably zoomed this in. That's what it's supposed to look like. That's
not
much better. I'm going to zoom back in because I can't read it that size.
But yeah, I mean, you know, like here's this opportunity. Sell us on the future. Like, tell us where this is all going and why building this together with you is so much better than putting your energies as a developer or your dollars as a consumer towards Amazon.
Maybe not.
Facebook
maybe the smartest
that.
Thing would for them just to shut up.
But see, this is what Google doesn't do. Google doesn't shut up. They build
Apple
their
shuts
products
up.
Exactly. Google builds their products in front of you. Sometimes they fail. But they always are basically, you get to see how the sausage is made. Apple, they keep it secret. And then when they have a fully realized product, usually, unless it's like a beta like Siri or Apple Maps, then they'll bring it out to you. This is actually something that Mark and I have been talking about recently, just as friends, but also on our Buzzkill podcast. But it's like, this is a difference between those companies. Facebook,
where's my plug buzzer?
Yeah. Facebook also, you know, with their F8 developers conference, They're further behind on all this tech, but they showed some like, you know, cute camera apps and it got people excited.
I kind of respect a company like Google where they're not going to do the flash. They're just going to do the – and remember, it's a developers conference and they're not going to try to impress.
Well, it's a developers conference, but these keynotes have been so filled with consumer news that the expectation these days is that you're going to have something flashy to show
I was
off.
A little disappointed we didn't see anything about Chromebook. We didn't see anything about a lot of consumer products. They didn't mention the Pixel phones. They didn't – they did mention Google Home and the Assistant now is on the iPhone, which is really a stealth introduction to Assistant to get iPhone users to understand, you know, that Siri you've got, that's crap. This is what a real Assistant can do. I think hoping to woo some people over to Android, but at least to get them to buy the Google Home. The other thing that maybe it's just me, I keep mentioning this and everybody's kind of ho-hum. I think the fact that you can make free calls to any phone in the U.S. and Canada on your Google Home is kind of impressive.
I think that amazes people our age.
Maybe it's because we're old.
Yeah. As we were saying when we were there, you know, we're old enough, fellow panelists, we're old enough that our parents would yell at us to get off the phone.
Yeah, because it's long distance. It's costing a lot of money.
Right. See, to me, that's not impressive at all.
Because your cell phone does that.
Yeah. And you have unlimited minutes now.
Exactly. It's like...
Because they don't want to talk on the phone. Nobody wants to talk on the phone.
If I have to go to my phone to set up my speaker should know that my phone exists, and it should be able to basically be a speakerphone. Like, that doesn't seem
crazy. You millennials don't
take... You can call all the other Alexas.
You can only call other Echoes.
Yeah.
So in a couple of ways they scooped, I thought they sort of, you know, scooped Amazon's big announcements the last few weeks, because that was one announcement, is free Echo to Echo calling. Big deal.
Yep.
And they also have, by the way, some privacy issues because there's no way to block calls. So the fact that anybody who figures out how to get a hold of you on your Echo can bug the hell out of you in your house
Is
a problem.
No thanks.
But then remember, Amazon has announced but not yet shipped this Home. What do they call it? The Show?
The Show.
The Show has a screen on it. It's really just a tablet with an Echo built into it. But Google says, well, we didn't do that because you got screens all over the house. So how about... if you just can cast your calendar your TV or any other, you know, cast ready screen in your house, and of course most people have cast ready screens all over the place now.
Yeah.
So I thought that was impressive.
It does make me wonder though if and this is something that Megan Maroney brought up actually, and we were talking about it earlier, is whether or not this puts pressure on Amazon to come out with a phone again. Because even so, you know, Google has its apps on the iPhone, and they of course have Android, but basically if you're using an iOS device or an Android device, they have a presence on your phone. And the reason why this might be a little bit of a jump ahead for them in this smart speaker phone calling thing is because they have access to your phone in ways that Amazon doesn't yet.
Well, and that's the other thing Google has to kind of think about is the creepy line, right, Jeff? I mean, every time they announce something, there are going to be a group of people, privacy advocates, to say, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
I don't know. Putting that
especially in Europe.
House. Yeah.
Right.
The Google Lens is kind of funny. They announced this is an AI capability that reminds you a lot of Google Goggles, which and Amazon's Fire Phone.
7 years ago.
Right. But I asked somebody at Google who was involved in integrating this into search and photos. She said, well, but this is AI. You know, Goggles was kind of pre-populated. We had to teach it. This is learning all the time. So, for instance, I love this. They take a picture of a flower. This happens to me all the time. What is that flower? And it will actually say, oh, that's a milk and wine lily. And it will even give you nearby florists. You can order it and buy it.
That is cool.
That's a business proposition for Google, but I think that's cool. If you have barcodes on the back of your router, it will automatically configure, you know, connect to it by just taking a picture of it. It can read it. And my favorite one was they showed, you know, you using your phone, and I'm not sure what app this is. Maybe it's just the camera app because that has Lens built into it. You turn on Lens, and then you point at different storefronts, and it'll tell you what the star rating is. You know, how much it costs. You can make a reservation. How many?
So this is AR beyond what Facebook can do because Google has all that data.
Well, and it, you know, I know Apple at some point. Apple's going to announce AR. This seems to me exactly what Apple might announce in the fall, and I think they've scooped them a little bit. Here's an example of. They took a picture of a marquee at one of my favorite clubs in San Francisco, Bimbo's 365 Club. Of the Stone Foxes are playing May 17th. So the Lens is smart enough to know that that's a Stone Foxes, offers you Stone Foxes music, offers to add that to your calendar, nice. Which is pretty impressive, and shows you where you can buy tickets to that, all from taking a picture of the marquee. Those things seem like the kinds of things that would be useful over and above what Goggles could
do. It's an entirely new user interface with a computer. They had typing, now they have conversation, and now they have sight.
Can we get into some Amazon topics? I've been waiting to fight our episode with Tom,
well,
and it hasn't come up yet.
This is the one I wanted to bring up because while I'm in this news drought in South America, I read another story that Amazon bought Whole Foods for $13.7 billion. And again, I thought, what? And I couldn't wait to get back here and ask y'all what you think of this. Amazon buys Whole Foods. Now, there's some wags who said, I don't think this is how markets work, but who said, you know, Amazon stock went up by more than $13.7 billion. So in effect, it was free.
Yeah.
It wasn't a stock deal, though. So
yeah. It's not really how it works, but
But it certainly was a good move, at least from the point of view of the market. They thought, hey, this is a good acquisition. Is it? Why would Amazon buy a brick-and-mortar grocery store? Who wants to start?
Had some struggles. Actually, I'll let you know. Yeah.
But Tom Merritt, because apparently Owen J.J. Stone thinks they're going
to
have a fight.
I wanted Owen to go first so I could just take the opposite of whatever he says.
Oh, that's Owen's technique. Oh, man, a little jujitsu.
That is my technique. That is it. See, Tom, this is why I don't like Tom. I'm trying to get Tom out of here. Tom, no. But look. This was the greatest deal known to man. Are you crazy? Do you know how awesome this is? Okay.
Why is this a good deal?
Let's hear it.
First of all, Whole Foods, a.k.a. Whole Paychex, has done the marketing research, and they only are in rich environments. Those people are the people that can afford to pay Amazon to deliver and or pick up and or drop off their expensive groceries because regular people won't do it. So taking an Acme or a ShopRite or a Lion or whoever grocery stores are going to help you. This is a national food grocery store. So get coast to coast, Key West to Key Largo. There's a bunch of benefits.
Key West to Key Largo. That's both in the same state.
It's a, don't go listen the other to way. What I'm saying.
It sounds good, though.
question what I'm saying. Just listen to what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, it's great for them because they have mini markets in certain areas that are affluent areas to test their whole pantry system and food it's that like, they're trying to sell.
Key West Tequila goes like 10 miles.
That's why like, are you stuck? I said 32 things in 5 seconds. You stuck on Key West Tequila. Shut up and listen.
It sounds good, though. I like it. Go ahead.
This is a smart dinosaur. Most companies, Blockbuster, sat there and watched Redbox eat their lunch. They watched Netflix eat their lunch, and they didn't do anything. Amazon is the end-all, be-all of retail selling, and this is a strong foothold coast-to-coast, San Francisco to Miami, that's going to help them expand their grocery brand that they are obviously moving forward to. They're probably going to scale back on the high-priced items, but it's a great move for them, and it gives them a foothold in something that they bought, quote-unquote, on the cheap, they quote-unquote got for free. It's great.
It wasn't that cheap. I mean, that's by far the largest acquisition. The next biggest one is like Zappos for $2 billion.
It's expensive to me. It's cheap to you, Uncle Leo. It ain't nothing but a thing to you.
That's true.
You see what I'm saying?
Jeff Bezos, what does he make? Somebody said he makes like $10 million a day. So I guess he could afford it. Yeah,
they had some cash on hand, too, so they could afford it.
Boy, this looks good, doesn't it? I think this is nice.
I don't disagree with anything that Owen is saying. The thing that I was saying about Whole Foods was their profit margins have been degrading.
They've been a little bit in trouble, right? They're not.
They've been fending off a little bit of activist investor pressure. So this was a way for them to make an exit to somebody who can absorb that pressure and not worry about it, because Amazon runs on thin margins all the time. Amazon just made Amazon fresh again, because they get a presence like Owen's saying in all of these different markets, and they get brick and mortar outlets that they can use as distribution for that. The problem is Instacart has a 5-year deal with Whole Foods. So they're going to have to figure out what to do to either break that deal or coexist with Instacart delivering Whole Foods for 5 years. And Instacart's out there immediately saying, Amazon is a threat to every other grocery store. You want to sign up with us right now.
Yep. Is this, though, I mean, it seems like that, assuming that this is a deal about Amazon delivering groceries to its customers, seems like it's less than it really is. It feels like there's more to this than just that.
Oh, more than just that. Yeah. And I think they obviously want to jumpstart the same thing they've been doing with the brick and mortar book retail stores. And there have been a lot of rumors that they were thinking about doing electronics outlets, and they have that Amazon Go convenience store. So they may be, if they can get the kinks worked out, thinking of bringing that kind of technology into the Whole Foods outlets to make them, you know, super high tech places to shop. So yeah, I don't think it's just about delivery, but that's the big early win for them.
It's funny because as Ben Thompson points out in Stratechery, it was only 2 years ago that Whole Foods CEO John Mackey predicted that groceries would be Amazon's Waterloo. So if you can't beat them, buy them.
Yeah. Here's how I think of this deal. And Larry Dignan on ZDNet has, you know, my colleague, has written really smartly about it. He watches great. This stuff, and he's pretty skeptical too. He's pretty bullish on it as well. And obviously we've talked about it a lot, but here's kind of how I think of this. There's a real similarity that Whole Foods and Amazon have, in that Whole Foods was struggling because all of these grocers were carrying the same products that Whole Foods carries, a lot of them, not, you know, all of them, obviously, but they were carrying, they were starting their own brands to do all of these same kind of organics, you know, clean eating kind of products. And that was slowly siphoning off more of Whole Foods' business. Amazon had, you know, its biggest threat. I mean, let's be honest. Amazon is such a monster right now. In the U.S. last year, in the holiday sales, which is when, you know, everybody makes all of their money in the fourth quarter, Amazon owned like 40% of the holiday, you know, gift market. The next closest competitor, I believe, was Best Buy in the low single digits, like 3-4%, right? So,
but who wants to buy milk and eggs and bread online? I don't understand
Leo, it's not that. It's what they're going to do. So their threat, the biggest threat for Amazon was all of the clicks, the brick and mortar, some of the bigger click and mortar ones, you know, getting smarter about online. They are getting smarter. Their digital transformation efforts are happening.
Walmart is probably the biggest threat to Amazon, right? Walmart, and vice versa. Walmart realizes
Amazon's the biggest threat to Walmart. Yeah, Walmart's throwing a hissy fit right now. Walmart's out here trying to do mafia style stuff. Oh, you shopping at Walmart? Then you don't want to come over here. Like, they're doing weird stuff.
They're encouraging their partners to pull out of AWS and move to like Azure or something else.
Isn't that wild?
That's Soprano stuff. That's mafia.
If you was to want to continue to do business with us, you probably would want to reconsider your relationship with Amazon.
I'm not saying nothing bad's going to happen, but you might not walk again.
Walmart flipped out when they saw this, right? Walmart flipped out.
Yeah. All right, we haven't talked about Travis Kalanick yet.
I got my shot glass ready to pour a little out for dearly departed Travis.
Uber. Yeah, it seemed for a while there, every week there was a new Uber story, just unbelievable story.
Groan after groan.
Of course, the story this week, Travis Kalanick, great story in the New York Times about how the board decided to fire after hours of drama.
We are the board. Resistance is futile.
Mr. Kalanick's exit came under pressure after hours of drama involving Uber's investors, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. And their phone calls and hotel calls and Bill Gurley, who, by the way, he was the venture partner at Benchmark Capital, one of the big investors, has left Uber's board to put another partner on the board. Maybe he's somehow tarnished. But Kalanick was in Chicago. A letter hand-delivered to him says, Mr. Kalanick, time to say goodnight. Now, he's still going to be chairman of the board. He ain't going really anywhere, but he's not going to have day-to-day operational management. Interestingly, 1,000 Uber employees signed a petition saying, we must have him back. He's the only guy who can run Uber. But the investors clearly felt that he was more of a liability than an asset to the company. Your thoughts? Tom, you start. Go ahead.
Tom, go ahead.
You got the shot glass in hand.
I think this is a very difficult situation for Uber to be in. They have virtually no C-level executives. They have a committee of 14 people running the company. Travis Kalanick was doing the things that he needed to do at this point. Now, you can rightly say too little too late as far as forgiving him personally, but he was finally saying, yes, we're going to get rid of people. We're going to change the company culture. I mean, Arianna Huffington was right there next to him, cheering him on, saying, here's all the things you have to do. And yet that faction of the board said, you know what, we'd just rather have you out of the way so we can pick an adult.
And maybe not that they didn't think the world of Travis or his abilities, but just that it was too much of a liability.
And I think what is odd to me is that they didn't have a candidate already lined up after
that
all
is interesting, right? We don't know who's taking his place.
Yeah, and that will be the telling tale here, right? If they were to get a Sheryl Sandberg, I don't think they'll get Sheryl Sandberg to leave Facebook, but if they were to get somebody like that, that makes sense to me. If they get someone unknown or someone who doesn't have a proven track record, then that makes not a lot of sense at all.
Yeah, and in fact, you're right. What it would have made sense is to go out and talk to a Sheryl Sandberg or to... I'm sorry, let me... I hate autoplay video. Thank you. Or go out and talk to Susan Wojcicki. She's been floated as the CEO of YouTube.
Yep.
Maybe a guy... Maybe somebody like Alan Mulally, another person whose name has been floated, former CEO of Ford, who is currently, you know, just kind of hanging out, not doing anything, and a smart guy. And if you think that self-driving vehicles are important to Uber's future, might be a good choice. Wouldn't you go and talk to some of those people and say, look, we're gonna boot Kalanick?
Yeah.
Maybe
because the reason you get rid of Kalanick, as far as like just brass tacks, if you're the board, I think you get rid of him. Obviously not to please the employees because you've got a bit of an employee revolt going on, but because you want to polish it up for the IPO. You don't want to have this in the way for the IPO.
And regulators.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, you got to consider government issues. I mean, Uber's been fighting the government since day one, local government.
They just they obviously considered him a toxic asset, you know, at this point. And so he had done a lot. His obviously super aggressive. He is the one that made Uber, and for better and worse. And they have a lot of stuff they need to clean up and clean their house. And they just decided that he wasn't the one to clean it up. Like, he's the one who created the mess. Having him clean it up, you know, probably doesn't work. Is essentially and with what him the owning, board decided.
When he owns the majority of voting shares, the only way you convince him of this is to say, we need to bring in a caretaker CEO who's going to guide us through the IPO and make that really profitable for you, Travis.
And so it's worth ideally, it to step aside. Ideally, a woman, right? Because if you bring in a woman, then you can maybe get rid of that, shed that bro yeah. image.
And then yeah. maybe you so, even say, yeah. Travis, we'll bring you back after the IPO a year or two later.
Boy, it seemed like we did Travis Kalanick and Uber stories all year long. This was Uber's no good, very bad year, all year long. Alex Wilhelm, of course, is a regular. We love Alex. He's a great journalist and a lot of fun. But the weirdest thing is he's living, or sometimes anyway, his girlfriend lives in my childhood home in Providence, Rhode Island. And from time to time, he's actually slept in my boyhood bedroom. And the man without a country, Alex Wilhelm.
True.
He is he's a bi-coastal.
I now am bi-coastal,
there's
yes.
a rumor floating.
Oh, you
around.
Are?
Yeah, I can say it, right? Yeah, I live in Leo's old house, ironically, in Providence part of the time now.
I grew up, the house I grew up in when I moved out of when I was like 15. He's living in my house.
No way.
My girlfriend owns it.
He's living in my mom and dad's bedroom.
it's pretty funny.
Talk about confusing.
I just got back a week ago.
I'm so confused.
It's a great place.
How did you guys figure out? How did you figure out it was his house? How did you make this connection?
So his girlfriend was visiting, and she mentioned that she grew up in Providence.
Right.
And I said, oh, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. And she said, oh, where? And it took us about 30 seconds to figure out she owned my old house.
It was, oh, I live God, on Street X. Oh, my gosh, me too. I grew up in X
She
number.
Said, what house on Street X? And I said, there's 21. And she said, that's my house.
Yeah.
Wow.
I took pictures for you.
That's, by Small the way, world. That's when I knew we're in a simulation. That proved it. That's the glitch in the Matrix. I now know right. it's a simulation. Does that happen to you guys? It happens to you every once in a while. You know? Oh. Simulation.
Nothing on that scale. That's pretty amazing.
That's a glitch in the simulation.
If this is a simulation, I want to re-roll my character with better hair.
Too late.
Okay.
Part of you got to understand the rules of the simulation. The whole idea is that this is it. You rolled the character. You got to go from birth to death. This is it. There's no fixing.
Do I get to try it again?
Yeah, next time you can roll a different character. But
all right.
You've decided to do a chaotic mage, and that's it. You've got to live with that.
I don't even know if that's offensive or a compliment. I'll just take it. Let's do it.
The simulation is saving RAM. It's right untoward. They didn't have enough RAM to have more houses. And they thought, well, what is the chance of a collision? Oh my God, we had a collision. There's some operator, some system, and going, oh crap. Now I got to rewrite that code.
Why did I give IBM this contract?
Yeah. You should have put more RAM in the damn thing. All right, Amy, we're going to put you on the spot. You have to represent all of womankind. Although a number of men jumped in on this. So apparently there was a memo placed by a Googler, as yet unnamed Googler, although if his name is ever revealed, I think we'll find out about it. He posted it on apparently a Google meme site, as well as the internal equivalent of Google+. And the full content of the memo has been finally revealed by Gizmodo. They got it. Wasn't probably very hard. And I'm going to try to characterize this so that people can react to it. The reaction's been very, very strong. You know, Google has had a diversity problem. The FTC's been trying to investigate them. Google said, no, you can't have any documents. Google says, we're satisfied that we're doing enough to hire more women and more minorities. It's apparent, though, if you look at the numbers, they're not. Women engineers represent 1 in 5 Googlers. African-Americans and Hispanics, even worse. I think it's 1 or 2% African-American engineers at Google's engineering division in the United States. But this memo says, well, this is just another form of discrimination, all this diversity, all this attempt to, let me see if I can find the text of it.
It's pretty long.
Yeah, I don't want to read it.
I can summarize.
Can you, Amy? Go ahead.
So there are different sections of it, but the gist, the sort of gist of it is women don't make good coders, according to the person who wrote this, because
they're genetically just not suited.
Right. Genetically and socially not suited. Now,
they have other skills, he's saying.
Right. But women are extroverts, men are introverts. Right. So there's like a whole litany of
women
of
like people,
why.
Men like machines or things. This is like Larry Summers, the then president of Harvard, saying, well, women aren't good mathematicians. It's just genetically the case.
Tell that to Ada Lovelace.
Yeah. Here's what I would say. My viewpoint on this is possibly a little controversial. I don't think so. But you know, I would say that we are not all the same. That, you know, women and men are not the same. But I would also say that within women, there's quite a bit of diversity, just like there's quite a bit of diversity within men. The three of you sitting at that table are not, you know, archetypes or carbon copies, right, of each other. At least I don't think so. And by this guy's definition, you know, I would read like a 16-year-old teenage boy if we agree with what he, you know, how he delineates the genders in the memo. So there's a couple of things going on. He's making broad generalizations about women and about men, which any sociologist would tell you don't track. So his generalizations all, you know, and anybody who's a coder has taken math,
right,
which means that he should have known better than to generalize to begin with.
He says, so science will back me up. The sociology proves that.
It doesn't.
But it doesn't. So that's point one. It's just wrong.
Point two, this had to have been a pretty low-level engineer because the way that he's describing some of the work would tell me that he hasn't yet worked on any more advanced projects at Google. He's probably like an entry-level 23-year-old kid. Not that there's anything wrong with 23-year-old kids, but what it does tell me is that, you know, his work has been binary. So he hasn't had to solve any real problems. Right. And anybody who's ever had to think about the future or about the past or solve any real problems understands that biodiversity is a good thing.
Yes.
You know, and that teams are requisite. So to me, you know, this was probably written by somebody in reaction to either a bad performance review or a bad day at work or, you know, feeling left out of the club, or maybe he got rejected by a fellow coder, developer who happened to be a woman. You know, it could have been any of those things, but there's so much inexperience throughout the entire memo to me that, you know, it sounds like some petulant 20-year-old who's who doesn't have a lot of experience and doesn't know what he's talking about anyway. So I wasn't super angry or upset by the memo. Right. Now, what's been interesting is the reaction to that memo, which to me almost feels a little inauthentic. It feels as though in the year 20, what was the year that movie PCU came out? Do you guys remember that movie? It was like
mid-90s.
Early Jeremy Piven.
It was quite some time ago. It was like 94, 95.
I feel like we've circled, you know, all of history cycle, right?
Yeah,
I feel like we've hit that cycle again where our responses are expected. And I feel like some of the responses that I've seen to this memo have almost been formulaic.
What about Google's response, though? That's the one that really matters. And some people have been critical about the Google management's response to this, which was, we want to make a safe place at Google for all beliefs, including these beliefs.
Which is why it would make me think
official,
of PCU.
Was that a press release that they...
Yeah, that was their official response to it.
Right. They just hired a diversity head.
Yeah, she's literally been in the job 2 weeks and then this blows up.
So it's interesting you say what you said, Amy, because I before the show you mentioned you hadn't read Yonatan Zunger's Medium piece about this.
No. I had.
You had. Okay.
Yeah.
So he was. He's actually.
And he said the same thing.
He said exactly the same thing. He's a very well known Googler, very politically active, He has recently left Google, so he said, well, I could speak a little more freely about this than I would have if I were still a manager at Google. And he said exactly the same thing. He said, when you first start coding, you are just dealing with a machine. But as you get more senior, you realize really the job is not coding. The job is solving problems, and in particular, interacting with other people to solve those problems. It isn't. And I think you're right. I think a lot of young coders starting off think what coding is all about is learning how to instruct the machine. And he says, essentially, this is Younger, engineering is all about cooperation, collaboration, and empathy for both your colleagues and customers, something that the memo writer said, oh, those are female traits. If someone told you engineering was a field where you could get away with not dealing with people or feelings, then I'm very sorry to tell you, you've been lied to. Solitary work is something that only happens at the most junior levels. And in fact, the traits which the manifesto described as female are the core traits which make someone successful at engineering. But I think the bigger issue, Amy, is that the lack of diversity at Google and in Silicon Valley, does it hurt Google? Does it hurt the product?
Well, I would say yes. And I would say, you know, one of the things that I'm researching most intently is artificial intelligence. So that's been a big part of my life for the past couple of years. And you can see the strange and weird ways that AI is starting to break or break down. And that's you know, a result of having too few people with too narrow a worldview trying to solve problems together. So, you know, everybody that I know that works in tech likes to talk incessantly about nature, and yet they seem to not take some very basic cues from nature. Nature tells us, you know, that biodiversity is good for the ecosystem. And it's always good to introduce, you know, complementary species and life forms, you know, to be together. What I find so interesting is that we see, you know, study after study and anecdotally and just evidence all around that biodiversity is great. And yet we don't seem to take that advice when it comes to staffing the offices.
It's a monoculture.
You know, where the stuff is being built. Right. Now, you know, it's difficult, and it's hard to have this conversation without using those broad generalizations.
Right. Well, that's, you know, I want you to school me, because, and I'm gonna walk right into a minefield here. But that's okay. I want to be educated here. It is true that, I mean, and of course, every individual is a unique individual, and many guys have more female traits, many women have more male traits, whatever. My wife is much butcher than I am. But it seems to me there are there gender differences?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask, right? I think Dinesh D'Souza, who's a, you know, right-wing conservative writer, would tell you that stereotypes are born out of fact and that they exist for a reason. I think that any sociologist who's had any real training would tell you that it depends on the data set. And gender is not just influenced biologically, but also by the cultural norms and standards in each country and region and everything else.
And yet, you have kids, right?
Yeah, I have a kid, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a boy and a girl. And I'm pretty convinced that we did not in any way try to push them in any direction. But the boy liked playing with, you know, guns and balls, and the girl did not.
Right.
And this was out of the womb. This was very early on. I don't think this was socialization. So I agree. There's a massive debate over nature versus nurture. And I don't.
Right.
And it's very hard to know what's nature and what's nurture. I guess. Look, I think we do need diversity. Clearly, we need diversity in Silicon Valley and everywhere. Every workplace is better if it's a diverse workplace. It's just better for everything, for everybody in the workplace. I know that. That's true. But part of the reason that's true is because people bring different flavors to it. And I think I don't think it's unreasonable to observe that women bring different flavors than men. Or is that really a bad thing to look at?
Here's what I would say. Humans are not wired for change. We are, you know, our limbic systems react very poorly when the status quo is challenged. That puts us into fight or flight mode, you know, and it causes us to make bad decisions. And more importantly, it causes us to pine for the way that things used to be. And it's because of our limbic systems that, you know, a lot of people are not good at thinking about the future. However, if we look from a statistical standpoint, that change is often better, right? And that it helps us approach and understand the future in a better way. What's happening right now is that technology has, you know, reached a certain inflection point. We have enough people who are trained that can go into the field. We have enough compute power to be able to work on meaningful projects. And, you know, because of how things have always been, those roles are predominantly dominated by white males and males from other, you know, a few other countries. So this is really about change. And it happens through every field. If you look throughout time, it's happened in every field and in every case. And once that change happens and the workforce has become more diversified, you know, they tend to be more productive. They do better. There's all this data showing that. So I think when it comes down to it, we're just dealing with the latest round of this, and we feel it and sense it acutely because it's the field that we all pay attention, that us, the people who are on this show and who are listening to this show, watching it, it feels acute because we pay attention to it, but it's the same story that's been written over and over again, you know, in law and in academia and, you know, in all of these other different fields and industries.
One of the transitions that happened this year, affected us, of course, was the loss of the great science fiction author and regular contributor to Twit, Jerry Pournelle. And I just, you know, I asked the team, it happened a few days before the episode, can you put something together? And I'm just so grateful. It was Victor Bognot, Karsten Bondi made some suggestions. I made some suggestions. And they just did a beautiful job. We thought, boy, we can't end the year without a revisit to our tribute to our great Jerry Pournelle. Watch. Our guest today is somebody that I've been a fan of literally for years, ever since his column in Byte magazine, and he's certainly influenced my career. Let's welcome Jerry Pournelle.
A lot of people couldn't figure out why in the world was I better known than anybody else in the computer business, except maybe Dvorak. I wrote the Field and Stream column. Me and Joe went hunting. Well, me and old Zeke went compute. And that was the great secret I never told anybody.
Great many, if not most, scientists were heavily influenced by sci-fi and focused their research on areas that science fiction inspired them to study, which is why, in so many ways, modern scientific advances parallel what you guys are writing about.
When you get around to listening to The Mote in God's Eye, pay attention to the pocket computer. I wrote that in 1972, and an iPhone does most of what it says in there. But, of course, we had to set it a long way away because even in 1972, nobody thought that I would live to see.
Isn't it amazing?
Most of the people in this world accept fruits of technology in about the same way as a kitten accepts milk when you pour it into a bowl for it. There was a common phrase in the robot industry, you never understand how smart a moron is until you try to program a robot. It towards the end of the Soviet Union, and Panovich, which was doing the handwriting recognition software for Microsoft, he said, my biggest problem is I don't have enough technical handwriting. Then I got my logbook out, you know, that's the technical handwriting that was the standard, and that engine has been in every edition of a Microsoft handwriting recognition program since 1990.
How is your handwriting, Jerry? Are you?
It's god awful.
Okay, great.
It is really terrible. X projects are this: go out to some place like Edwards or some awful place where nobody wants to be. Go out there and you tell them, I want you to build the best whatever it is you can build with technology as of this afternoon. You build three copies of it. We test one to the edge of it, and we probably prang it. With the second one, we fly in because we learned from the first until we get all the information out of it. And the third one ends up in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, Jerry's the wordy one. Yes. Larry has told a perfectly good story. It would be publishable now. But when I'm finished with it, it will be probably half again, maybe twice as long. And then he goes over it and finds some scene that what everybody will remember, and they'll forget that I ever had any part in it. What the hell? I've always been an operations research guy, you know. That's a guy who knows less and less about more and more until he knows nothing at all about everything.
One last question. You ever going to write your memoir?
Maybe, although in a sense I'm writing it now, aren't I?
Maybe after a year or two we'd have the whole thing. No, maybe take a little longer than that.
How many people do you know whose personal computer has been on display in the Smithsonian?
You're the only one I know of.
Yeah, probably all of them, yeah.
I know all of them.
The great Dr. Jerry Pournelle. Was an honor to consider him a friend. We'll miss him. Thank you, Jerry. And Godspeed. Edget 22 made an amazing discovery.
Oh, my gosh.
She looked at Kentucky Fried Chicken's official Twitter account, at KFC, and noticed it followed exactly 11 people.
Mm-hmm.
Five Spice Girls and six guys named Herb.
Oh, my gosh.
11 herbs and spices. This probably is the most viral tweet of the last 5 years.
The Spice Girls would pronounce it herbs.
That's true.
Herbs.
That's true.
I've got 11 herbs and spices.
That is amazing.
Is that the social? Kudos to the social media director.
It's a Louisville company.
Good job,
Yum
Sam.
Brands. Actually, I know their social media director, so I'm going to ask about that because that's incredible.
Find out if he's the guy. That would be a great story. Is he the guy who thought of this?
It's a lady.
It's an Easter egg, though, right? Yeah. You do this and you don't tell anybody.
Oh, amazing.
Easter. You wait for somebody to notice it.
But you said social media director, which is the right thing. People were like, oh my gosh, that social media intern is so great. And then people that work in social media were like, not the intern. That takes actual thought, planning, and execution.
Yeah.
Don't diminish the value of the work that just went viral and brought KFC, not just attention on social media, but right here. I'm now saying KFC, which I don't say ever, but good for them.
You'd have to, and actually, Edget's pretty smart because this is the people that the KFC is following. You'd have to kind of say, Jerry Horn, oh, that's Jerry Halliwell. That was the Spice Girl. Wait mm-hmm. a minute. Official Mel B, she was a Spice Girl. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five Spice Girls.
Who are the herbs?
And then Herb Scribner, Herb Wesson, Herb Waters, Herb
City
Dean,
Council.
Random Herbs, and Herb
Council.
And Herb Alpert.
All verified herbs.
He's a great trumpet player, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, they are all blue checks.
All verified herbs.
Oh, they did all verified accounts too.
All verified herbs and spices.
Well, you want to look legitimate, right? You can't just follow.
Because milkshake duck, your herb can become. Have you seen that thing? Oh, so milkshake duck is a meme. It says, like, oh, look, we all love milkshake duck. And then 5 minutes go by. We're sorry to inform you that milkshake duck is racist. Whenever the internet finds something that's lovely and nice, it turns out to be bad. So if you found a herb that was non-verified, he may become milkshake duck and accidentally racist. Then KFC has to apologize, thus ruining the moment. So by following verified accounts, there's probably a lower level of that happening.
Yes.
Anyway, social media is hard, and that was hilarious.
Social media is hard. Kudos to anyone who has to manage social media. I can't even manage my own.
You're pretty good on Twitter.
So, milkshake duck in the Urban Dictionary is defined as a person who rapidly becomes famous for something wholesome before they're revealed as a deeply flawed character with terrible opinions and or a shady past.
Welcome to humanity.
Yeah.
Do you remember Ken Bone? Remember Ken Bone?
Yes.
Ken Bone.
Yes.
Ken Bone. And then
Sweater
all,
Boy from the from
then
the debates.
All his adult video habits from Reddit were found out.
Oh, poor Ken Bone.
Yep, exactly. Don't become famous. Don't do it.
Incognito mode.
Yeah.
Just don't leave comments on Reddit on porn under your own name.
Incognito mode. Well, the good news for Apple is... We have a number of data points. Of course, Apple's own quarterly results came out the day before the iPhone X shipped. And they say they had amazing sales of iPhones. The iPhone sold 46.6 million units in the fourth quarter. Much of those probably iPhone 8s. iPhone 8 was a success. And then, of course, Slice, which is an interesting story. I don't know. I'd love to hear whether you guys trust it or not. I use Slice. Slice is an app that monitors Gmail to see of its customers, and there are, I guess, millions of users, monitors Gmail to see if your delivery is coming and when it's coming. So they have advanced information, admittedly a sample, but I think a fairly large sample size. And they say, according to their customers, their users, it's the largest product launch in the company's history. This is the graph. The iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, kind of one of the smallest product launches in the company history. But the iPhone 10 even bested the iPhone 6, which was huge because it was the first big iPhone. This is pretty significant. Do you, Brian, are those useful numbers, you think? Are these, I feel like Slice is useful.
I haven't been an Apple reporter in several years, so I really don't remember. But are they scanning receipts or something in emails? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's how it works.
I think Apple has disputed those metrics before. Like, just from what I remember, they don't love them. And I'm not sure if it's because they're too accurate or if they're totally wildly off. But I do think that early orders are definitely a good metric for, early adopter interest and just, like an indicator of whether or not a product is very interesting to technology enthusiasts. I don't know if it really tells us much about the long term over the course of a year.
Sure.
But it definitely is interesting to see the iPhone 10 and so much excitement over it.
Yeah. Well, I think three out of the four of us have one in our hands. Ed Bott is still using his Nokia 1050. No, I'm teasing. But I wanted to hate this phone. For the price, for the attention it was getting, I just wanted to hate this phone. I wanted to find something wrong with it, and I can't find anything wrong with it.
So do you use an emoji?
I have sent some. That is not going to be a killer feature, I don't think. I've sent a few. And, of course, our friend Harry McCracken claims to have invented something that is really going to end the world sooner, which is Animoji karaoke.
I don't know if he was the first one to do it.
He claims to have invented it. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know either, but I'll play a little bit for you in case you somehow have missed the excitement of Animoji karaoke. It's actually kind of a hard thing to do because what you have to do is record using the screen recorder because you're limited to 10 seconds. No, this is an ad. Let's see if I can find it.
I think that Renee has an actual how-to on the iMore site.
He does.
Of how to do this yourself. If you so wish to torture the rest of the world with an emoji.
And maybe Renee's found a better way to do it, but what I was told is that you have to use the screen recorder and then edit out, crop out the UI stuff, and then you can, according to BuzzFeed, Harry McCracken invented it. So, and then you can mix it into a, here's Harry's first, or one of his first. So he's got a rabbit and a chicken singing.
Oh, that's good, though. That is good.
Singing Blue Swede's Hooked on a Feeling. Now, I just want to remind ASCAP BMI that this is in use, in service of news and commentary. Not being used for any aesthetic value. Although I think it's pretty funny. So how does Renee's technique, does he have to use a screen recorder and all of that?
Yeah, I think he's doing also, yeah.
Yeah, here's another one from Harry. This is the first one. It's Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd. There doesn't apparently exist an Elmer Fudd Animoji. It's kind of a limited. Actually, there's some concern about, believe it or not, I managed to find all the negatives. There's some concern about this because Apple, of course, Apple says the Face ID information is stored in the secure enclave, is not available to anybody else. We don't see it. Only the phone sees it. And it does a very good job of recognizing you. I'm actually pretty impressed with Face ID. It's as good as it could be, I think, in the circumstances. But there's some concern because there is an API for third-party developers to use the cameras in the notch. I imagine Snapchat be one of the first, right? Wouldn't that be a great way to use get those Snapchat characters, use the notch and do a better job of it? And there's nothing to stop them from exfiltrating that information from the phone to the Snapchat servers. All the information delivered by the notch. So there's some.
So you choose to say yes or no.
You have to approve
to
it.
An application. So yes. You would approve it if you feel comfortable with them, maybe knowing how you feel when you look at
and,
their app.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the ACLU and the Center for Democracy and Technology say, well, maybe this is a problem. I don't know. You have to really stretch. You're right. You're right. You have to approve it. They ACLU says a lot of things about Face ID. They don't like it. But something to be aware of. Senior policy analyst at the ACLU says, you know, a bad guy could, you know, what? Get your face. Big deal. All right. I'm trying to find negatives. I really am. It's not easy.
It's interesting because Face ID misses me when I'm grumpy. Like if I have a grumpy face,
yeah,
it will miss me. Now, and if my hair is in my face, it'll miss
me. You have a choice of having it require that you're paying attention, looking at the phone or not. I would imagine it's a little easier if you don't turn that on. I've left mine on so somebody can't sneak up behind you, and I don't care about that. But
and grab your phone and then have to try to unlock it, not just steal the
phone.
And
all you would have to do is go, I'm grumpy.
All I have to do is be grumpy. That's it. Which I probably would look shocked if someone, you know, smashed my... like, that would probably be enough to stop
I have some anecdotal evidence that it does get better. Apple said it would get better. Because occasionally it doesn't recognize me. When I was, I did it first with glasses. When I didn't have glasses, it didn't. I entered the code. So then you have to use your PIN. But from then on, it recognized me with glasses. So I have a feeling it's updating all the time.
Yes.
And Apple said it would be. And I think there is evidence it's doing it. Same thing. The studio lighting confused it at first. Not anymore. It gets better. It's pretty impressive.
There was
it's to the point
a
where
a brother.
Go ahead.
A brother, you know, did the exact same thing. So they had similar faces and two brothers unlocked the phone by, you know, having the phone relearn the new face, which was actually the brother's face, which was similar enough for the phone to be mixed up. So there's probably, you know, some updates that will make it a little bit more attuned to that. But it is constantly trying to relearn. Like if I probably do the passcode with a grumpy face, it would probably notice grumpy Georgia.
It doesn't. So when it doesn't recognize you, it asks for the passcode, you enter it, and I suspect it's then it's saying, oh, well, that was you, I guess. We'll add grumpy to your repertoire. We did try it with identical twins. Megan Maroney, one of my co-hosts, tried her iPhone 10. She had one of her sons, Huck, unlock it with his face and then gave it to Milo. Milo was able to unlock it. This is what Apple said could happen with identical twins, and they were right. So that's a drawback. You can only have one face in there. Unlike the fingerprint, I used to let my wife have her fingerprint on there so she could get to my phone when she needed to. Now I have to give her the passcode. iFixit ran to Australia as they are wont to do to get an iPhone 10 so they could destroy it. We had Kelsey from iFixit on the new Screensavers yesterday. A couple of interesting things. A, they gave it a repairability score of 6, which is not bad. Better almost than I thought. They found the batteries in two modules. It's an L-shaped battery with two different modules. And as a result, the logic board has an odd shape and is jam-packed. They figured out it has 3 gigs of RAM. Apple never talks about that, but that seems more than adequate. Of course, it has the A11 Bionic, as we expected. It actually has quite a few custom processors on it, which is kind of interesting. It's got a lot of smarts in here. There's they give the chip numbers, but there's definitely a motion coprocessor in there and some other things. It's for such a tiny logic board, there's a lot of stuff in there. All right. I don't know what else to say. That's the iPhone 10. Jeff Bezos, by the way, now officially, for once and for all, the richest man in the world. 100.
You got to show the picture, dude. There
it is. Yeah. This has become a meme.
Actually, Bezonator.
Yeah. He's buff. But then, of course, it was an internet meme, and there's all sorts of other images of him walking down looking. But is this at the Allen? This might have been at the Allen Co. meetings. They put The Rock behind him, you know, also looking buff. Let me see if I can find that, because Bezos did an interview this week with his brother. And his brother and he, there you go. There's the picture with The Rock. And who's that other guy? That's
Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. Yeah.
Come on, Leo.
Bad and the Furious.
Yeah.
And so they were, they actually, his brother put that up on the screen, and they were laughing. They were laughing. His brother, though, if you look at his, Jeff Bezos' brother, he's been hanging out at the gym. Well, let's see if I can find a picture of this. So he got his brother, as one would expect, got him to reveal a lot about himself. For instance, every summer from the time he was about 6 to the time he was about 17, Bezos would stop it. Autoplay video. He would go to his grandpa's pop, he called him, where there was nothing. There was no connectivity. Bezos spent his summers working on his grandfather's ranch in South Texas. He says, I learned my resourcefulness from my grandfather. He tells some stories like the time his grandfather leapt, I don't know if I can tell this, do this story justice, leapt out of the, he's driving the pickup truck off the ranch. He leapt out of the pickup truck. I've done this. Who doesn't? Trying to open the gate without stopping the truck so he can open the gate, jump in the truck and keep going. Accidentally, wow. The truck runs into his hand, his thumb, and cuts off most of the top of his thumb. They rush to the hospital, and Pop, Jeff's grandfather, says, he's so mad. He says the thumb was hanging by a thread. He's so mad, he takes the thumb, rips it off, throws it into the bushes, goes to the hospital and says, I don't want my thumb reattached. Just take some skin from my butt and put it over the hole. And ever after, Bezos is telling the story, he'd have butt hair growing off his thumb that he had to, when he shaved, he would shave his thumb. And now you know how he's the richest man in the world.
I don't think the dots quite connect on that story.
Well, the point Jeff was trying to make is I learned resourcefulness from my grandfather. He bought a non-working combine. This is not Jeff. Jeff doesn't have the butt thumb. His grandpa has a butt thumb. He bought a non-working combine and said, Jeff, your job, Jeff is like 12, is to get that thing working. And they ordered parts, and Jeff worked on. Some of the parts were so big they couldn't lift them. So Grandpa built a crane, a homemade crane, so they could lift the parts into the combine. He said, "This is where I learned how you invent your way out of the box." He says, "Choosing his wife, same thing." He,
oh jeez,
should I stop? He says, he was doing the Dayton thing. Like he had the app, he was doing the Dayton thing. And he said, I just want to find a woman who's resourceful so that if I hurt myself, she can, I want to find this. It's just the funniest. If you get a chance, just read the interview. I guess that's the bottom line. And I'm not making up the story about the thumb.
Yeah, the moral of that story is throw away the thing that you really need when you're mad at it and then cover it with butt hair.
As a kid in Montessori school, Bezos describes how teachers would have to physically move his chair from one task. You know, at Montessori works. By the way, there's his brother who lifts even more than Jeff. Look at that. He was in Montessori school. You go from task station to task station. Jeff would get so focused that they had to actually pick up his chair and move it. He's not a fan of checking his phone at the dinner table. He's not big on multitasking. Even when it comes to his email, multitasking bothers me. If I'm reading my email, I just want to really be reading my email. Kids, that's how you become the richest man in the world.
Honestly, multitasking is mostly a crock, right?
It is. You can't really do it.
Focusing is better.
No, you can't really do it. Grandpa's hairy thumb. You know, one of the things I take pride in on Twit and is the titles, right? Ever since we started Twit 600 some episodes ago, what is it, 643, I've always tried to have interesting, compelling titles, maybe not the best SEO, maybe not a title that makes you, you know, have to listen, but just something fun. And I like to kind of make it almost an Easter egg. So it's always something in the show that somebody says, and it always has to do with something we're talking about. That particular story from Jeff Bezos gave us one of my favorite titles of the year, Grandpa's Hairy Thumb. I love that. And I want a shout out to the chat room because, in a way, at the end of our shows, it's always a competition. The chat room is, you know, firing off title ideas. And very often, in fact, almost always, the title idea comes to the chat room. So thank you, chat room. Thank you, everybody, for watching. I'm so grateful that I get to do this show every Sunday. some of my favorite journalists. We don't have a regular panel on this show because it's a chance for me to talk to all sorts of people, and I hope you enjoy that. Let us know, you know, keep watching is the best way to do it, and we will make, I promise you, some great shows for 2018. Have a happy new year and safe new year. We want you back next year. We'll be back here doing Twit January 7th, a whole new episode, lots of fresh ideas, and of course, all the tech news. In fact, that'll be our CES edition. We'll see you then. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Happy New Year. Another Twit.
This is amazing. Is in the can.